Cuando escuché la noticia que habían agarrado al Chapo con un nudo en la garganta, estos versos fui juntando.
Joaquin El Chapo Guzman, the notoriously brutal head of the Sinaloa cartel in Mexico, was captured over the weekend, and there's already this narco corrido about his arrest.
Del mundo, capturado en Mazatlán, por un gobierno corrupto.
El Chapo upped the cartel game in Mexico over several decades, and now he's behind bars. What's next for drug culture in Mexico? Tracy Wilkinson is the Mexico City bureau chief for the LA Times and has been covering this story since El Chapo's arrest on Saturday. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Well, you know, his slipperiness over the weekend, despite his final apprehension, is really indicative of how he has eluded the authorities for many, many years, right?
Well, yeah, since 2001, when he escaped from a maximum security prison, supposedly in a laundry cart, although who knows if that's really true. He's someone about whom there has just been so much legend, so many stories. But I think the important thing to remember is that he clearly was able to pay off lots of people, officials, police, the military, and kept himself very free for a very long time until now.
And then he was able to elude the authorities by building all these complicated tunnels, which he also used to transport drugs, right?
Also correct, yes. He had tunnels. He had, you know, they say that he would sometimes disguise himself. For a long time, he moved around in large groups with many, many bodyguards, which made the authorities afraid to go after him. More recently, he's been moving around, we are told, in smaller groups so as not to attract as much attention. But yes, he had just an entire network of ways to get around, to elude authorities, and it's said he may even have gone up to California a few times. You know, one of his wives gave birth there a couple of years ago, and so he may even have been, you know, crossing the U.S. border and going into the United States. So he was definitely very clever and had a million ways to elude detection.
Right. Now, speaking of the United States, he significantly increased the flow of drugs into the United States. In fact, people in Chicago are saying he was more powerful than Al Capone in terms of his drug smuggling. How did he manage to do that?
Well, he was very smart. You know, he, unlike some of the other cartel leaders, he was not as vicious. I mean, I'm not saying he was a good guy by any means, but he was not as vicious and flashy, so he tended to stick to the business, and he was the consummate businessman, and so he was able to expand the Sinaloa cartel into, at one point, I'm told, 200 cities across the United States, plus another 50 or so countries, Europe, Africa, even into Asia. I used to work in Italy, and the mafia there was already working with the Sinaloa cartel years ago. So he was just a consummate businessman who kept attention off of him, kept a certain amount of discretion so that he could build the business.
Yeah.
And that's what he did.
And apparently Forbes said he was worth more than $1 billion.
Yes, yeah. Forbes had him on there on their billionaire list for a few years.
Right.
Along with Carlos Slim, the big, one of the richest men on the planet.
Yeah, from Mexico. Well, so, but how is he? He wasn't able to really spend the money, I understand, because he was living in jungle hideaways or up in the mountains or something. Not living necessarily
a
lavish lifestyle.
Yeah. Exactly. He had his hideaways. He, for the longest time, was up in the mountains. But, you know, I don't think he was slumming it. I think he had a very good life up in the mountains. And only more recently had come down to the cities, we're told. And so that's how they finally caught him. But I would not, I think one of his biggest achievements was the way he laundered money. Yes, he moved the drugs and, became this huge drug trafficker. But he also was was an expert in laundering money. So I think he has money everywhere, millions and millions and millions of dollars. And he spent some of it in some places. And you know, he's got a huge family that has also been a beneficiary of that money. So I wouldn't worry about him not being able to spend the money.
Right, right. So now that he is under arrest, who's going to take over? Who's the next Guzman, next El Chapo, if you will?
That's a good question. His sort of right-hand man was Ismael Zambada, the El Mayo Zambada, who was, I mean, some people even say he already had kind of become the day-to-day operations chief of the Sinaloa cartel. So he's there. There are a few other top lieutenants who are very much, in charge of sections. It's unclear, you know, usually when they take out a big drug lord, there's a fight among the next tier, among the lieutenants, a big power struggle. But some people are telling me that the Sinaloa cartel was so well organized that there may not be that power struggle, and that already one of his family members will take over Guzman's, section of the cartel, while El Mayo Zambada and these others continue to run the other section. So we may not see the same power struggle that we've seen in the past.
And so what happens to him now that he has been caught?
Well, good question. The U.S. is interested in extraditing him, so that's one possibility. You know, when he was arrested before and got out of, escaped
right.
from prison, so a lot of the Americans are very interested in having him come up to the U.S. because then they figure they can really, keep hold of him. But he could also tell, he has a long story to tell of all the many officials who helped him over the years. And so I think there's some Mexican authorities who maybe don't want to hear that story and would rather he just be sent off to the U.S. On the other hand, if they really let him talk, you could really get deeply into how the authorities here, how the network, how the government really protects drug traffickers. And that would be a fascinating thing to learn. But I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. They'll either keep him here and keep him quiet or send him off to the U.S. We just don't know yet.
Is that something the president would want? Peña Nieto would want him talking freely?
I'm not sure, because frankly, I think it would implicate a lot of people in his political party, because they have a reputation through the 80s and 90s of having very close deals with a lot of the drug traffickers. So I'm not sure Peña Nieto would want to see that. We just don't know yet.
All right. Well, we'll see. Tracy, thank you.
Thank you.
That's Tracy Wilkinson. She's Mexico City Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. In the last 8 years, more than 70,000 people have died in the Mexican drug war, and the death of one leader, even the head of the Sinaloa cartel, is not likely to end the bloodshed. Alfredo Corchado is Mexico Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News, and he wrote the book Midnight in Mexico, A Reporter's Journey Through a Country's Descent into Darkness. We reached him in Juarez, Mexico. Welcome.
Pleasure to be with you, Melanie.
Okay, so how will the capture of Guzman affect Mexico, do you think, if at all?
Well, I'm in Ciudad Juarez, and that's where we've been focused on, because anytime you have a narco of that magnitude, we're talking about the most powerful cartel leader in the world, you're likely to have some repercussions. Juarez has been the site of extreme violence in the last few years. The last couple of years, things have calmed down significantly. But over the weekend, there was a lot of excitement and giddiness, almost kind of akin to Osama bin Laden being killed. But I think underneath it all, there's also a nervousness, and the question, will the violence resume? As you have a huge power vacuum, and someone will try to fill the shoes, and along the way, you're expected to have a lot of bloodshed.
Yeah, so the Zetas were a rival gang. Are they now going to assume more power?
The Zetas have been weakened significantly in the last year or so. There is that concern that the Zetas, that the Gulf cartel, may try to enter places like Ciudad Juarez. But I think more imminent, the concern is really that the Juarez cartel, which was kind of given up for dead, this will revive them. It, doesn't, you know, the capture of Chapo Guzman doesn't mean that the Sinaloa cartel is gone, is dead. I mean, he's Chapo Guzman is much more of a mythical figure, a figurehead, if you will. But the brains behind the organization, people like Ismael Mayo Zambada and Esparagosa, known as Azul, I mean, they're alive, they're there. And I think everybody assumes they have a succession plan. So it's not the end of them, but you will see, I think, people trying to jockey for a position in the days and weeks to come.
And what is the role of the government in this? Because there have been lots of allegations that the PRI, the party in control of Mexico for decades, was working hand in glove with the cartels, including this one.
Well, what's unusual about this operation in particular is that it was led by the Mexican Marines with assistance of U.S. officials, U.S. law enforcement officials from ICE, which is now known as Homeland Security, people from the DEA, U.S. Marshals. Those are the ones who kind of led the operation on the ground, which is unusual because when the PRI came back, there was a sense that they were telling the Americans to leave, to this was a new page. What would be interesting in the next few days and weeks is how much will we learn about the pre-involvement? I mean, how corrupted were they? How high was the corruption? In the past, unfortunately, when you've had these kinds of arrests, nothing really happens. I mean, we never really understand more. So I think a lot of Mexicans feel that if we don't know more about who was involved, you know, follow the money, if you will. If it's just a Chapo arrest, then it's really a partial victory for Mexico. They have to get to the bottom of just how corrupt were the institutions, and who was taking the money where.
Yeah. Well, so what are the suppositions with regard to that? Because when he first escaped from prison many years ago, allegedly in a laundry basket, it was because dozens of prison guards and soldiers helped him, that they were on his payroll, and that indeed Mexican police and the army have been corrupted by the cartels, including the Sinaloa cartel.
Well, there are allegations that the corruption leads to the highest levels of the Mexican government.
To the president?
I don't know. I mean, that's been one of the allegations. Again, you know, in Mexico, you kind of live in a land of conspiracies. And when you live in a country where the institutions are so weak, rule of law, I mean, the conviction rate is less than 5%, you will always have conspiracy theories and you will always have people pointing fingers here and there. We really don't have that kind of evidence, but the allegations are certainly there.
And you said that the violence has died down a little bit in Juarez. Why is that?
The violence has died down in places like Juarez. It's moved to other regions like Michoacan and the state of Guerrero. In Ciudad Juarez, there are a lot of reasons that people talk about a stronger civil society, the fact that during his presidency, President Calderon invested more than $400 million to try to kind of help the infrastructure of the city and also build more schools, et cetera. But I think the overriding theory has been that the Sinaloa cartel had won. I mean, they killed, enough key people to claim victory. And that's why I think people are a bit nervous over the weekend that the capture of Chapo Guzman may again open the old wounds. As one person put it this weekend, we fear that the devil will once again roam the streets of Ciudad Juarez.
And the devil being what exactly? Being rival gangs battling it out for turf?
Exactly. Rival gangs, killing, the violence will return. At the height of the violence, more than 3,000 people were killed in the year 2010. Last year, there were less than 500 people killed. It's quite a dramatic shift, but people, they haven't forgotten the past. It still looms very much, you know. And it was interesting over the weekend. You know, you're talking to people, and they're kind of looking around. You're looking at local police, state police, nervously driving their vehicles. We hope for the best, but past examples have shown us that much uncertainty comes after the capture of such a leader.
Yeah. Well, as we heard at the beginning of the segment, there are narco-corridos, and one has just been written and produced already about the capture of Guzman. What is the feeling there when a big, as you say, almost mythical figure gets captured? Is there a mixture of emotions? Because, after all, they're seen by some as Robin Hood figures, as heroic figures.
I think, yeah, I mean, there is a mixture of emotions. When you talk about the violence in the last few years, it was really more the product of the FETAs, you know, the paramilitary group in Tamaulipas who were known for their brutality and the viciousness. The Sinaloa cartel always had much more reputation of being businessmen, I mean, ruthless business leaders. But they didn't kill at will, it wasn't as rampant as the FETAs. I mean, I think the Sinaloa cartel inspired generations of young people who, you know, lived by the principle of I'd rather be a king, live like a king for 5 years than a slave for 50 years. And so he had that quality of the Robin Hood, inspiration for younger people. Nonetheless, I mean, he was also ruthless. I mean, he was part of the killings that have left more than 100,000 people killed in Mexico in the last 7 years. You know, 100,000 people killed or disappear. So, I mean, he was no saint. But I think for younger people, there was always that sense of, you know, the rags to riches story that inspired many people.
Did he do anything good for the communities that he, I don't know, that he felt a part of?
Well, in interviews I've done in places like Sinaloa or even Chihuahua, people talk about Chapo has done more than the government. I mean, they built roads, landing strips for planes, et cetera. They helped schools. They celebrated the day of the children, Christmas. I mean, so it's debatable. I mean, yeah, did he do good? But, I mean, there was always the sense that nothing comes at a free price.
Alfredo Corchado is a reporter and author of the book Midnight in Mexico, A Reporter's Journey Through a Country's Descent into Darkness. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up, the man behind Ghostbusters, Caddyshack, and Groundhog Day, remembering writer-director Harold Ramis, next on Press Play.
Check out our new YouTube video channel, The Q. KCRW DJs curate themed video playlists and feature artist clips straight from YouTube. Add some visual to your audio. Explore now at kcrw.com/theq.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The film world lost one of its comedy trailblazers today. Harold Ramis was the man behind so many huge and now iconic movies, from Groundhog Day to Caddyshack, Animal House, Analyze This, and, of course, Ghostbusters, which he co-wrote.
Well, let's say this Twinkie represents the normal amount of psychokinetic energy in the New York area. According to this morning's sample, it would be a Twinkie 35 feet long, weighing approximately 600 pounds.
That's a big Twinkie.
Harold Ramis died early this morning from complications related to a rare disease. He was 69 years old. And we have one of his biggest fans and one of our regular film contributors on the line now to talk about Harold Ramis and his impact. Devin Faraci started the Badass Digest, a website on movies, TV, games, and books. Hi, Devin.
Hi, Mallon. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. So how would you describe Harold Ramis' legacy and his impact?
It is so enormous. Everything that we think of as comedy today really can be traced back to a lot of what Harold Ramis was doing. He was the bard of the oddball. He was the guy who made being weird the coolest thing that you could be. His movies were just the most beautiful odes to underdogs, and they were also the funniest movies that you could imagine. He was absolutely a genius.
Yeah, you called him sort of the master of the slobs versus snobs genre, if that is
a
genre,
that was
in
like
fact.
That was really his thing. I mean, if you look at like Meatballs or Animal House, even Ghostbusters has this in it. It's the idea of the underdogs, these guys who should not be doing what they're doing, rising up against the the preps and the higher ups. It's very anti-authority. You know, Hal Ramis came out of that '60s counterculture and had a very strong feeling of being anti-authority. He brought that into comedy in a very big way.
And then you also wrote on your blog today that he was able to combine the highbrow with the lowbrow. And I don't think a lot of people think of those movies as highbrow at all. I mean, they're fun and everything, but highbrow is not necessarily what comes to mind. What do you mean?
He is able to really work in these really great jokes that I think work on a level for people who are smart, but are also, you know, play to all audiences. You know, Caddyshack, the line to quote Jean-Paul Sartre, "Au revoir, Gopher." I mean, like, you know, not many people remember that particular joke. They think of the poop in the pool joke, but then right. He has both side by side. Animal House is full of a lot of really great, really smart satirical comedy that is just sort of hidden with the rowdy stuff.
I think we have a clip of tape that might illustrate what you're talking about. It is from Groundhog Day, and it's Bill Murray playing Phil Connors, the egotistical weatherman caught in this never-ending, it seems, space-time loop.
I was in the Virgin Islands once. I met a girl. We ate lobster. Drank pina coladas. At sunset, we made love like sea otters. That was a pretty good day. Why couldn't I get that day over and over?
So there's Bill Murray exhibiting some existential angst, speaking of Sartre, right? He worked a lot with Bill Murray, Harold Ramis.
Yeah, Murray and Ramis were almost a perfect comedy couple. You know, Harold Ramis was a great deadpan foil to Bill Murray. That was sort of the role he found himself in. He had begun in doing sketch comedy with Second City, and one of the first things that Harold Ramis did was work with John Belushi. He quickly realized that Belushi was so big that he had to find a whole different way to perform, and he found this comic foil persona. And with Bill Murray, I think he found the perfect guy to be up against. It's that Peter Venkman, Egon Spengler back and forth in the Ghostbusters films, I think, personified. They really got each other.
Right, right. So he acted as well. We keep forgetting, but he was in some of these movies himself.
Harold Ramis definitely did. Yeah. He's terrific, obviously, in Ghostbusters. Egon is one of the great comedy characters of all time. He's amazing in Stripes. He's appeared in a bunch of his own movies, and he's acted in tons of other films. He's also performed on SCTV. He was the head writer for the first 3 years of that groundbreaking television show.
And also performed, we have a skit from SCTV from the early days, talking ironically about death back in 1977.
I'm Maurice Green, licensed chiropractor. Did you know that each year more than 20,000 people die? Well, this year you may have passed away without even being aware of it. Here are seven simple warning signs that may spell the difference between life and death for you. One, prolonged absence of physical activity. Two, loss of appetite. Three, loss of sight and hearing. Four, increasing stiffness of joints and muscles. Five, relaxed attitudes toward personal hygiene. Six, inability to remember the previous five warning signs. And seven, the unexplained presence of coins on your eyelids.
So there he is in 1977 on SCTV. And so tell us about how he influenced other comedians and the comedy genre.
You know, I think it's just about the smartness of the writing and the way that he made it so effortless. And also I think that it goes back to him being that deadpan foil. He knew how to work with other people. I think that everybody who worked with him, there's a word that I've seen come up again and again, which is teacher. People felt like he worked with them in a way that helped them understand their craft better. And he was really selfless in that way, which is, in comedy performers, that can be very rare. But he was the guy who wanted to make sure that everybody else was very funny as well. And I think that was a huge impact. I think that just the kind of comedy that he had, the sweetness of it. The thing is that even as raunchy as it ever got, there was always something very hopeful and very human about all of it. And I think that is what is going to be his legacy. His later films ended up being about searching spiritual stuff. That's why Groundhog Day really continues to resonate with people right now.
Yeah, so not just as a comedy, but as something more, something deeper.
It's about something bigger, yeah. All of his stuff was, even stuff as silly and dumb as Animal House, is about, you know, searching for kind of human freedom, if I can be so pretentious when talking about a movie about a frat.
Yeah,
but it's all there from the beginning, and like I said, towards the end, he really began to tackle movies that allowed him to go that way a little bit more explicitly, including Bedazzled, the remake, which I think is an underrated film of his, but especially Groundhog Day.
All right, Devin Faraci, he started the Badass Digest, the website on movies, TV, games, and books. Devin, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And we're remembering Harold Ramis, who died early this morning. He was 69 years old. So what's your favorite Harold Ramis film, and what do you think he'll be best remembered for? You can weigh in on our voicemail, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or on our Facebook, KCRW's Press Play. Coming up, the singular passion of a French expat who's built his monument to the history of the world in the California desert. That story is coming up after this news update with KCRW's Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
After I sold my company, we had bought some land after the Korean War. And I said to my wife, well, we're going to go sit in the desert and think of something to do.
That's the voice of Jacques-André Estall speaking in a New York Times video. Estall moved to an isolated plot in California's Sonora Desert some 30 years ago. And it really didn't take him long to find something to do, like start a town. Today, the 85-year-old and his wife are the only residents of Felicity, California. Estall is also the mayor. And it has become a popular, quirky pit stop for travelers on the nearby interstate. And that's partly because of the town's 20-foot-tall stone and glass pyramid. Inside, a plaque declares it the official center of the world. But that's not even the weirdest part of Felicity. The town's other attraction is a massive monument called the Museum of History in Granite. John Mualim is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, and he wrote about Felicity in the most recent issue. Welcome.
Hi, thanks a lot.
Well, how did you come across this crazy little town?
Right, yeah, you know, I think I had heard about it from friends who, you know, live down in Southern California. You know, when you drive by on the 8 going towards Phoenix, you pass Felicity, but I'd never really known anything about the town, just that it was there, just that it existed, and it was somehow strange. And when the magazine decided to do this Journeys issue and they needed another story to fill out the issue, it had to be done on a little bit of short notice, and so I figured I'd better go somewhere close to home. So I live in San Francisco, and I think I literally just started, you know, Googling, like, weird California or, you know, interesting roadside California, something like this, and when Felicity popped up, having heard about it, I started doing a little more digging, and as soon as I found out about the man behind the place and some of the stories involved, I just realized I really wanted to go there.
Yeah, so you meet him, and just describe him physically and his whole presence.
Sure. So Mr. Estall, as I was careful to call him, he turned 85, actually, the day that I got to Felicity. And, you know, he spent half of his adult life jumping out of airplanes. He was instrumental in kind of the making of skydiving into a sport. So he's a very fit guy. He had done, you know, 100 push-ups and 100 sit-ups that morning when I got there. And just really kind of has a big kind of love of life and a commitment to what he's doing there. He's not very introspective about what he's building there. He doesn't like to talk about why he's doing these monuments or even why he built the town. But he's 100% committed to it nonetheless.
Yeah, you write that it is this Museum of History in Granite, which is this kind of lifelong project, it seems, that he wants it to last for 4,000 years. And that you say that it is stupefying and unsurmisable catalog of human triumph, folly, idiosyncrasy, and violence. And what's engraved on these panels?
Sure, it's this collection of big granite monuments, and then he's got an engraver and a really talented artist to do these hand etchings and text engraving on the panel. So basically, the history of humanity, for example, this is his most recent project. It starts, you know, with the Big Bang. So you've got a really wonderful rendering of the Big Bang in the rock. And then where he is to now is the Vikings. So it ends with a panel that explains sort of Viking death rituals. And in between, you've got everything from, you know, various empires and the origin of language all conveyed on these granite panels, distilled down to almost like a kind of fortune cookie type prose, so that everything is, you know, conveyed in just a line or two. So someone like Alexander the Great, you know, his life and career will, you know, Mr. Estelle has written, you know, three or four sentences about him, just kind of talking about his achievements and sort of the essence of who this man was.
Yeah, and then randomly there's a quote from Julia Child on there. If you're afraid of butter, use cream.
Yeah, he has a real sense of humor, so he likes to kind of combine these, you know, kind of great figures of history with some other things. There's a panel in a History of America, a separate monument, where he explains the national debt, and he does it with there's a cartoon of Elmo sort of showing you different lines on a graph. So there's this, all these juxtapositions of kind of, you know, the very serious and the very absurd.
Why does he want to do this?
You know, that was a question I kept asking him over and over again. I think for him, in some ways, he's such an impulsive person, and yet he commits himself to his impulses so completely. And I think really it started for him that, very simply, he just wanted to put some names of his friends and family in the rock and remember them that way, have a way to, you know, pay honor to the people who had been part of his life. And then he started realizing, you know, he could actually tell stories in these things, and that it would be a way of preserving not just his memory, but, you know, human memory and sort of passing that culture on. And that's sort of the most cogent explanation I was ever able to wrest out of.
And this must cost a fortune. I mean, these engravings look incredibly well done. And did he tell you where he got the money or how much it's costing?
Yeah, well, he comes from a very wealthy family. His father actually was a French, you know, distinguished French financier who helped, was on the, you know, panel that helped create the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. And then Mr. Estelle himself spent a long time, you know, investing in real estate. And then he ran these successful skydiving schools where he was, you know, teaching people to skydive. So he's, you know, in a long life, he's managed to earn quite a bit of money in many different ways. And he doesn't like to talk about it at all. All he kept telling me was, you know, I'd ask him how much something costs, and he'd say it costs more than a hot dog and less than a space shuttle.
That about covers it, I guess. So it's called The Center of the World. Why?
Yeah, another why question. He wanted to start a town. He wanted to start an official town called Felicity, which he named after his wife. And he decided, you know, he wanted this town to be important. And he wanted to actually, there was a time when he imagined people moving to the town and, you know, 20 or 30 or 40,000 people living there. And so he decided the best way to put it on the map would be to make it the official center of the world, just like, you know, Yuma, which is nearby, is the winter vegetable capital of the world. To Mr. Estelle, it was only just a short leap to just be the center of the world. He figured, why not? They're all just equally meaningless in some ways. And so he convinced the Imperial County Board of Supervisors to kind of go along with the joke. And there was an official declaration in the 80s that designated, you know, this one point in Felicity, the center of the world.
So he and his wife are the only permanent residents, and he runs the post office and he's the mayor. But there are other people who live there, right?
Yeah, well, so right now they built some apartments, and they're not very easy to rent out, it seems like. But right, there is a man who's been living there for 11 years who came and saying that he just wanted a month-long lease, but has been there 11 years. And then in the winter, you know, when I was there, there were many of the Estelle's friends will come and spend the winter there from, you know, coming from colder climates. So it's a pretty lively place, ironically. You know, it's a town, you know, I would walk around town and I would actually run into people and have conversations with them. I mean, granted, it was four or five people that were all living there, but it did, you know, you did have the feeling that you were stepping into some kind of community.
Wow. Now I really want to go. I'm intrigued.
I recommend it. Yeah.
Okay. It is the center of the world after all. John Mualim, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
And now joining us from our own center of the world, Warren Olney, to tell us what's up at 1 o'clock.
Thank you for letting me be here at the center. We're going to talk about the minimum wage, but we're also going to hear from both Kiev and from Moscow and get updates about what's happening over there. It's happening so fast you can't keep track. It's just amazing with the president now, a fugitive in his own country, and the Russians trying to decide what to do. So that's very interesting. The main part of our show, though, is about the minimum wage, increasing it. The president wants to jack it up to $10.10 an hour. Nationally, it's now $7.25. And here in interestingly enough, in California, there's the highest minimum wage in the country is in San Francisco. And Ron Unz, who will be on our show, is a guy that wants to raise the minimum wage in California to $12 an hour. That may be on the ballot in November.
All right. Well, we'll look forward to that coming up at 1 o'clock. Warren Olney and To the Point. And earlier before that, on this program, we will be remembering Bill Thomas, the editor who turned the Los Angeles Times into a nationally respected newspaper. He valued feature-style writing over news headlines, and we'll remember him coming up on Press Play.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW.
I'm Madeline Brand, and you're listening to Press Play. Time now for a weekly political wrap-up, and we're joined this week by John Myers. He's political editor at KXTV, and that's the ABC affiliate in Sacramento. Hi, John.
Hi, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Well, Democratic State Senator Ron Calderon has just surrendered to federal authorities, and he was charged last week with 24 federal counts involving taking $100,000 in bribes, and he faces up to 395 years in prison if he's convicted. So tell us more about this indictment.
Well, I mean, this is really the shoe dropping that we all wondered would drop and then started to expect to drop over the last several months. Because if we roll the clock back, Madeline, we know that the investigation of the Calderon brothers, well, actually now we know it had been going on for several years, but we learned about it last summer in June when the FBI raided the state capitol office here in Sacramento of Ron Calderon. And from there, we learned back in October about these allegations of a very long FBI undercover sting involving the Calderon brothers, money in exchange for legislation, in particular allegations of an undercover agent posing as a Hollywood movie producer looking for an extension of tax credits, California tax credits for movie production, and Senator Calderon having money there, exchanged to him payments to his daughter for salary. His brother, who's a former lawmaker himself, Tom Calderon, and his political consulting business through Orange County hospital executive Michael Drobot. A lot of allegations here of money for favors, and the bottom line is both of these Calderon brothers now facing these federal charges, and as you said, Ron Calderon turning himself in earlier today will be arraigned by day's end.
Yeah, and so he is going to face a vigorous defense by Mark Garagos, and he's just going to deny all the charges whatsoever?
I suppose. I mean, Garagos' early statements were, we look forward to, you know, refuting these in court. These are really, this is a very serious investigation. I mean, these are very detailed charges. And as I said, I mean, the investigation into the Calderons looks like it dated back into 2010. With the charges against in terms of moving legislation forward and helping out this healthcare company executive Michael Drobot, I think you know there are two questions here, Madeline. First, there's a legal issue, and I'm not the lawyer as to whether or not the Calderons are guilty. Will they enter a plea of some sort? Will there be some other arrangement? And then there's the political ramifications. Back here in Sacramento, Ron Calderon technically is still a member of the California State Senate, but you're going to hear the drumbeat more and more, I think, over the next few days about whether his fellow senators should vote to expel him, which would be the first time someone would be expelled if it happened in more than 100 years.
Wow. So this is a big scandal in Sacramento and for state politics. What does this mean for the Democrats?
I think it's a black eye for everybody who serves under the Capitol Dome. I mean, because it plays into the public cynicism about money and favors and politics. For Democrats in particular, they're the guys in charge. I think, you know, how fast they react to the Calderon issue will be an interesting question. They've stripped him of his committee powers several months ago, but, you know, they've resisted on this vote for an expulsion. But I think you're going to hear more of that, especially from Republicans this week. And I really think it's a matter of how fast it's over, and is it really limited only to the Calderons, or the allegations go beyond them? We don't think it does at this point. But I can tell you there are an awful lot of lawmakers recounting conversations they had with people now, trying to make sure that they are not somehow ensnared in this.
Right. Okay, well, let's move on to another political powerhouse, or trying to be. And this is a man named Tom Steyer, who held a $400,000 fundraiser at his home in the San Francisco Bay Area last week. Seven senators senators were present, U.S. senators, along with Al Gore, who called Tom Steyer Mr. Tipping Point. Tell us more about Tom Steyer, who he is, and what he wants.
Yeah, Tom Steyer is fascinating to me. So he's he's from the Bay Area. He made all of his money in the world of investments as a hedge fund manager, a billionaire with a very strong passion for environmental issues. He has put money into ballot measures in California before about energy and alternative energy. He has continued to talk about the need for an oil severance tax in California. It's widely believed he may want to put an oil severance tax on the ballot in California again, though at this point it looks like he would probably wait until 2016, not want to do that this year. He lobbies the legislature on that issue, and he's very passionate about the Keystone Oil Pipeline project. To the extent of running a television ad on national cable news before and after the State of the Union, trying to poke and prod the president to reject the Keystone Project, which he thinks the president will do, although a lot of the rumor we hear out of Washington is that maybe that's not going to happen. The Obama administration may approve it. So Steyer is a guy who has got a lot of money and a big message, and when you've got both of those in politics, that's a 1-2 punch.
Right, right. So he's being described as the Democrats' answer to the conservative Koch brothers. Is that accurate?
It's because he's got the money and he's passionate. I mean, he plays though much more visibly than the Koch brothers do. You don't see them delivering these large speeches in public. I mean, Tom Steyer was a speaker at the Democratic National Convention in 2012. So I think he's much more out there, but he is very passionate. And how many places he plays, I think, is going to be the real thing to watch. Is it going to be on the congressional level, on the state level? Does he want to move ballot measures? Does he want to continue to push the Obama administration on oil drilling? I think all these remain to be seen, but the guy does have momentum and money.
Okay, and finally, really quickly, we are finally going to get some rain later this week, and I'm wondering what's happening in terms of drought relief politics up in Sacramento.
Well, we expect now, we just heard just recently that the first of these measures, these emergency drought measures that the governor and legislative leaders rolled out last week, they're going to have a first vote in the state assembly probably as early as Wednesday. They want that fast-tracked and on the governor's desk by the end of this month, the very beginning of March, because they want to get that money out the door, either to work on conservation projects around the state or short-term assistance for farm workers who don't have any money because they're not bringing in a crop. So I think we're going to see something fairly quick, but it's short-term. It's not long-term.
All right. John Myers, political editor at KXTV. That's the ABC affiliate in Sacramento. Thank you.
You're welcome.
William Thomas. Bill Thomas has died as the editor of the LA Times from 1971 to 1989. He helped to realize the paper's ambition to become a nationally recognized newspaper. The Times scored 9 Pulitzer Prizes under his leadership, launched its Sunday magazine, its book review, business and calendar sections, and opened 11 new domestic and foreign bureaus. Hard to imagine that these days. Tom Rosenstiel is executive director of the American Press Institute, and that's a think tank on the future of news media, and he worked as a reporter at the LA Times from 1983 to 1995. Tom, welcome.
Hi, good to be here.
Well, tell us more about what Bill Thomas did to transform the Los Angeles Times.
He was the editor at a time when Otis Chandler had a very bold vision, which was to make the Los Angeles Times the greatest paper in the United States, better than the New York Times, and by doing so, putting the West on the map in a new way. And Bill's vision was to create a paper that was, in his words, a daily magazine. And if you remember the LA Times from that era, it had a story in the left-hand column every day on the front, at the top of the page on the left. And that story internally was called a non-dupe. Non-dupe was short for a story that was not duplicated anywhere else in the world.
Mm.
The kind of story you might only read in the New Yorker or maybe a handful of other publications, and the Times was expected to have one every day.
Well, they still have their column one stories.
Right, and whether the ambition to make it something that you couldn't read anywhere else or that someone spent 6 weeks or longer on is harder to do, obviously, now.
Right, right. He was criticized for the emphasis on these kinds of stories. Somebody said that he was the LA Times was the Club Med of journalism under Bill Thomas. Did he sacrifice an emphasis on hard news for this feature reporting?
Oh, I don't think it was sacrificed. I mean, the Times had the largest staff of any paper in the country. It also had probably the most generous profit margin because of the growth in Southern California during that time. So there was plenty of resources to try and do both. You know, your strength is always your weakness in any endeavor, and the more that you honor and reward your best writers and indulge them to take a long amount of time to do something, you tip the balance. You know, the boat is always sort of moving in one direction and having to make course corrections. But the LA Times also prided itself at that time in having no wire copy. Every story was bylined by a staffer. So there was there were plenty of people to cover breaking news. In fact, one of the perennial complaints inside the paper was they would send someone to Washington to cover the environment or some other specialized beat, and that person would always be pulled into whatever the story of the moment was in Washington. The other complaint was length, that stories would go on, and you know, and that it was indulgent of writers. It was a writer's paper, not edited heavily enough. Again, that's probably true to the extent that when you favor one thing, you always tend to weaken slightly another.
Mm. Well, what was it like as a reporter working for Bill Thomas?
Well, I went to the Times thinking I would be an editor. I had been an editor, and I thought, okay, this is my ambition. And what you discovered was that you could go so far as a writer that you didn't want to do anything else. I remember someone coming and saying, so what's it like to be here? And being told by me and by many others, the only thing that will hold you back is your own talent. You can do whatever you want here. Now, that wasn't true forever, but there was a time when that was true. Now, the flip side of that, again, was the editors were sort of not in control enough. A writer really could disappear and go off and do, you know, I mean, I remember one piece was a lovely piece where a writer went up the Congo River to replicate the journey in the Heart of Darkness. Mm-hmm. The irony of that, of course, in a paper where writers had too much control is too obvious.
Well, I mean, some might say that the state of newspaper journalism now is the Heart of Darkness, that since, right? I mean, since Bill Thomas left, there is a lot that has changed at the LA Times.
Yes. And really what Bill epitomizes in many ways is thinking how far, how good can a newspaper be if it has almost unlimited resources. And it tested the limits probably of what a reader could absorb in the course of a day. You know, there was an old kind of folklore, urban legend at the time that a dog had been killed because the Sunday LA Times had landed on it when it was thrown from a truck. There was no evidence to, you know, the kind of thing that was, as we say in the news business, too good to check out.
Right, right. Apocryphal. Right. Well, I mean, in a way, it seemed like he was ahead of his time in the sense that he said, or his philosophy was that readers don't have time to read the whole paper and they will pick the stories that they're attracted to. And for him to offer a variety of stories was important, knowing that readers' time is limited.
I think the other thing that I think that's true, and I think that another thing that Bill was visionary about was, two things. One, that there had to be things in the paper that you couldn't read anywhere else. Today in the news business, there's this notion of commodity news, that news is something that you can find anywhere, and therefore a publication that's just filled with that has not much value. And the other, I think, thing that Bill was very unusual about and forward-thinking about was he really was a collaborative leader, a listening leader. It was a newsroom of 1,100 people, and most people had never met him. but everyone knew exactly what he wanted. Everybody knew what was supposed to be in a left-hand column story or a bottom-of-the-page right-hand column story. It was a culture that was imbued everywhere, and as a young reporter, you would sit in the lunchroom and you would be taught these things by people who were had been there 3 years longer than you had or 30 years longer. That's the kind of leadership, actually, that Twitter aspires to or Facebook, where everybody knows exactly what the boss is thinking, but it's not dictated. It's sort of organic.
Tom Rosenstiel, Executive Director of the American Press Institute, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And we've been talking about Bill Thomas, former editor of the Los Angeles Times, who died. He was 89 years old. Jolie Myers is here now to share the mail. Hi.
Hi, Madeline. Happy Monday.
Thank you.
So we asked you to share your favorite Harold Ramis moments. And one of our listeners on Twitter said picking a favorite Ramis moment is like picking a favorite child. But Nick Triano on our Facebook page, he managed to pick one of his favorite. He says that there are so many great moments to choose from, but he loved the scene in Stripes where John Candy, another guy gone too soon, is explaining why he joined the army. Ramis's character is mocking from behind. Let's go ahead and hear it.
My name's Dewey Oxberger. My friends call me Ox. You might have noticed I've got a slight weight problem.
No.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I do. Anyway, I went to this doctor, and well, he told me I swallowed a lot of aggression, along with a lot of pizzas. Pizzas.
So you, of course, can't see Ramis in this scene, but he's mugging hard, and it's totally hilarious, his sort of deadpanning and his kind of physical humor on display there. It's good stuff. My favorite? Groundhog Day.
Yeah.
Gotta say.
I'm with you on that one.
I've been whistling I Got You, Babe all morning. I've also heard people going around the office humming the Ghostbusters theme, too. So if you have any favorite moments, write on our Facebook page, or you can tweet us at KCRW Press Play.
Excellent. Jolie Myers, thank you so much.
And thank you.
Yeah, this is a great opportunity to watch those movies over and over and over again.
Netflix.
Exactly. All right. Well, that'll do it for us today. Again, you can contact us in a variety of ways on our Facebook page, KCRW's Press Play, Twitter at KCRW Press Play, my own at The Mad Brand, or you can leave us a voicemail 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. I'm Madeline Brand, and that's it. Warren Olney is up next with To The Point. I'll see you tomorrow.